Full service radio.
You're listening to a recording of Lit City at the Line, which took place Tuesday, November 27th, 2018, in the lobby of The Line, Austin. The salon was hosted by the American Short Fiction magazine and Full Service Radio. I moderated a discussion between the two authors, and they both read selections from their recent works. We'll hear all of that, but first here's Rebecca Markovitz, one of the editors of the American Short Fiction magazine, introducing the event.
Hey guys, it's lovely to see you all. It's really very exciting to see this many people out here on a Tuesday night. It's a lot of new faces for us, which is always lovely. My name's Rebecca Markovitz. I'm a co-editor of American Short Fiction, along with Adina Reitberger, who's standing over there. And we're really pleased to welcome you guys here to the launch of an event series we're starting called Lit City at the Line. Very happy to see you all and to have you all here. I want to take just 1 second to say a couple of words about American Short Fiction, because some of you might not know it. It's a literary magazine based right here in Austin, Texas, founded here in 1991, that's distributed nationally beloved and award-winning, but it's really Austin's homegrown mag, and we want you guys all to feel ownership of it, because the city is a big part of what we do. It comes out 3 times a year. We publish just short stories in it, but those can be flash, they can be novellas occasionally, and we publish authors whose first publication is in our pages. We publish authors who have won many prizes. Joyce Carol Oates is in our current issue alongside somebody whose first publication is in the magazine, which is always nice. And if you want to, and Holiday Reinhorn, who's reading with us tonight, is also in the current issue, and if you want to check it out, our wonderful intern, Oriel Perez, is selling them just behind that column in the middle there for $12 each, and I encourage you guys to check it out, partly just to chat with Oriel, because anybody who spends a few minutes talking to Oriel has had a better day than they had before. But I also want to take a second, while I'm mentioning that table over there, to draw your attention to something we're doing. You'll have seen, if you walked in, a big, beautiful piece of art by an artist named Susie Davidoff, who very generously donated it to us. And what we're doing here tonight, because it's Giving Tuesday, as you may have noticed from 1 or 2 or 60 emails in your inbox today, is we're raffling off that picture to raise money to support wildfire relief in California. Holiday's flown in from Southern California. She was personally impacted by the fire, and her entire community was. And we thought it would be a nice moment to sort of raffle off. All the proceeds from the raffle will go towards Direct Relief, which is an organization that's doing great work helping out with the fire work there. Raffle tickets are $10 a piece. Feel free to get multiple raffle tickets and increase your chance. Take a good look at the picture. It's a beautiful charcoal drawing on hand-laid paper by Susie Davidoff, who's a really well-known artist. She's collected all over the country. She's collected in the Met, for example. I think in a gallery, this would be listed at more like $2,000. So a $10 ticket is a deal. Go check that out. We're going to pause when I'm done yakking at you for a few minutes to give you a chance to mill if you want to do that, or you can do it for a couple minutes. But we'll do the drawing basically right after the programming, because we don't want people to be stuck here waiting for it. But okay, so to move on, there's also a sign-up sheet there. Sorry to get all this bookkeeping out of the way at the beginning, but if you could sign up, we'd love to have your email address, because we want to tell you about more free events that we do. This will have further Lit City events, which we'd love to invite you to here at The Line. But also, this is partly supported by a grant from the city of Austin, and the city loves getting info about people's zip codes, and it's very helpful to us when applying to grants if you can fill out your zip code on that sign-up sheet, and you'll know about all the other cool literary stuff we're doing in town. We don't abuse the email list. We use it sparingly. But while I'm talking about The Line, this beautiful space that we're hosted in, I have total fireplace envy for this fireplace right here. Thank you so much to The Line for hosting and for being such lovely, generous hosts. I think Holiday's been saying how beautiful the room is that she's in. To Jackie at The Line, who's organized this whole thing. I don't know where you are, but you've been amazing. Take a chance to walk around if you haven't been in this hotel before since it's been redone, and look at the beautiful art that's on the walls. This is a hotel that the organization really cares about cultural events, which is why Jackie talked to us about running this series. And they have a lot of things going on in Austin that are exciting that you should pay attention to, but also just look at the art around. And it's a lovely space. So thank you to The Line. We're really honored to be in collaboration with you. We're super excited about this collaboration. Okay. Tonight, we're starting Lit City at the Line, which is we'll probably do about 3 events a year together with the Line, in which we pair a local, beloved local writer with somebody we bring in from out of town. And part of the thrill is doing this kind of matchmaking. And this match to us seemed so perfect, partly because these two women are the greatest mensches in literature, as far as I can tell. They're both just, they're those lovely people. And so it's a really nice combination just on that front. But, and I'm sure as Jack here talks to them, you'll hear more about that. But they're also, in their writing, they both write with really sharp wit, with humor, which is sharp, but then also they like to take in strays, I feel like, in their writing. They have these characters who find a home in their work that is comfortable and that maybe they didn't have a home before. And so I'm excited to hear what they read tonight for all of you. And I'll pass this over now to Jack.
Hello again. I won't give you too many more introductions, but thank you all for being here. Thanks again, of course, to Rebecca and Adina for everything that you do. And if you all haven't picked up the latest edition of American Short Fiction, definitely do that. Thanks to everybody at The Line. My name is Jack Inslee. I am the moderator for tonight, and I'm the founder of Full Service Radio. So very quickly, Full Service Radio is an internet radio station and podcast network that operates in The Line hotels. So our first studio is in D.C. So we have 32 weekly shows in D.C., all locals kind of telling their stories of the city, and we'll be building a studio here in the lobby of Austin as well, and in L.A. So this conversation will be recorded and available online for anybody that's not here. And if you want to revisit it, it will be there for you. So before we get started, we're going to start with some readings, and first I'll introduce the two incredible authors that we have here. First, Holiday Reinhorn, who has an incredible website. I'm going to start with that, holidayreinhorn.com. Plug, plug. We'll get to that later. She's the author of Big Cats. Her fiction has appeared in numerous literary magazines, including Tin House, Zoetrope, Plowshares, and has been anthologized in This Is Not Chick Lit, The Worst Years of Your Life, and Naming the World. The audiobook version of Big Cats, featuring a cast of award-winning actors, was released last year by Penguin Random House. A graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, Holiday is the recipient of the Tobias Wolff Award for Fiction and a Carl Gerassi Fiction Fellowship from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She lives in Los Angeles, where she's currently at work on a new collection of stories. And she's going to introduce herself with a short reading.
Hi, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here, and especially in Austin, the hometown of this magazine that I've been a fan of for so many years. I wanted to do a little excerpt of the story that was published in this magazine. It's very near and dear to my heart. It actually took me 8 years to finish it. I'd love to say that I work quickly, but sometimes on certain stories I work in like geological time. And so this one has like a bedrock feel to it for me. And it might be the title story of my new book. I'm not sure of stories. So I'm just going to read 15 minutes worth from the beginning, because it's a longer piece. And it's called Our Lady of Perpetual Sadness. This AM finds Chuckles and myself side by side at the open door of the half fridge yet again, taking way too long with the breakfast inventory. Not very much fits in a half-sized refrigerator, as it turns out, except for kimchi and 3 garlic heads in the door shelf. OJ, beer, and milk have to lie on their sides. Egg cartons go diagonal. There's not a reason in the world that yours truly and this human being, who is supposedly responsible for 23 of my chromosomes, should ever be standing shoulder to shoulder in this way, sharing the same view of anything. But for the past 3 mornings since I arrived in Honolulu, meeting at the feed bin bright and early in the pint-sized kitchen of his tiny condominium seems to have become the daily program. What about a creamsicle? Chuckles asked, lobbing his voice past me and over the minibar into the center of his open-plan living room. You like those? But there's no answer from out there yet. According to the district court summons of Oahu that I have been asked to keep charge of in my fanny pack, we have 45 minutes before the judge's gavel falls for the all rise to eat, shower, dress, and transport ourselves to the Waikiki Citizens Plaza to see our nation's justice served in The People versus Sonny Ricks, my once-in-a-while brother. It's pretty much common knowledge to all present, however, that no one inhabiting this dwelling is going to be capable of doing all four of those things in the brief time that's been allotted to us. Because I slept in my clothes from yesterday, I'm handling just the eat and drive part. Chuckles, I'm assuming, will do the shower and dress, and the one whose full name and social security number are printed on the summons is, as far as we know, still lying out in the living room on Chuckles' hide a couch under a crochet Afghan and Snoopy sheet, scoring zero for effort. Okay, comatose, Chuckles calls out again. I know you hear me, but my brother doesn't seem to. Maybe it's because he's remembering back to the days of cheerful upswing, when Our Lady of Perpetual Sadness used to stock ho-hos and Twinkies in the icebox and homemade popsicles that she'd make for the two of us out of frozen Tang. He liked cold treats when we were in the army, I say, watching Chuckles stab ice off the edges of the half-freezer door with a butter knife. He liked those 30 years ago when we were kids. You two were never kids. Well, we are now, I say, holding out my hand. After Chuckles tears open the paper wrapper, I take a seat on the single stool at his minibar and savor my orange and white breakfast, gently dunking it in the mug of Mr. Coffee he's just poured me fresh from the machine. Anyone who has not run away from home as an adult yet should definitely try it. You can go online, find miscellaneous relatives who want nothing to do with you, dead or alive, and especially not somewhere in between. Then fly to a Pacific island and eat early bird popsicles dipped in caffeine before driving them all to district court in your Hertz rent-a-car. Who wouldn't like to do this? Who wouldn't like to melt into the sweet, syrupy light of Hawaii that streams across an estranged father's formica every single morning and splashes into one's lap like a warm bucket of pineapple juice? The place where I found my father after 17 years of not looking was in a massive high-rise off Nuanu Avenue in downtown Honolulu, 13 blocks west of Waikiki. In the satellite photo on Google Street Maps, the building looked like it was commissioned during the Nixon administration, one of those facades from the opening credits of Hawaii Five-O designed to withstand multiple race riots or a Soviet bomb. The name of the residence was the Kwelealani, which sounded to me like it might be a retirement home for career military. At least that's what I thought it was when I showed up there after midnight 72 hours ago and rang buzzer 1809 for Charles Ricks. To tell the truth, I didn't really take into account whether or not he'd pick up, but it surprised me when he did, and in a fairly cheerful tone. Hello, he said, repeating it. Hello? Hello? Until it felt like his voice was rocketing around the vestibule, pinging off the walls like a ricocheting bullet. Who the hell is this? He asked. Who's down there? Nobody, I said into the intercom. Forget it. What? It's me, I said to him, Penelope. If this is you, you don't have to come down. It was quiet for a minute, and then I could hear some muffled rustling in the background. Ugh. I took my finger off the talk button then, waiting, and for some asinine reason, I could feel my eyes start to fill up. So this is really who I think it is, he said finally. The actual Penelope? You're kidding me, right? Penelope, the doctor? I stared into the intercom and swallowed. I said that it was. Well, I don't know if it's the real person, he said. Can I have your social security number, please? Oh, come on, Chuckles, I said. Fuck you. Yeah. Funny kid, he said then, after only a little pause this time. Hilarious. And I can do without your little pet names either. Sorry, I told him. I guess that one was always my favorite. Well, we're on our way down anyway, he said. Just give us a minute. What do you mean, us? I asked him. What does that mean? But I didn't get an answer until the elevator doors slid open a few minutes later and I saw for myself. My little brother was almost bald and much heavier too, but I recognized him. He had come down barefoot, surprise, surprise, and without a shirt on, wearing only a baggy pair of swim trunks, which by the look of them were currently functioning as pajamas. Wow, Pins, he said after the ear-splitting entrance buzzer faded away. How's it going? Pretty good, Sonny, I said when he hugged me. I don't know. Well, shit, he said, that is crazy. What is? How you look like her, Sonny said, shaking his head. She looks really mom-like now, doesn't she, chuckles. Wow, I say, looking over at my father. I guess it doesn't matter what you decide to call him then, huh, Sonny? But chuckles ignored both of us. Your sister looks tired, he said, nudging Sonny away from me and toward the luggage. Help me bring her in. To be honest, the military man who fertilized our lady's eggs was looking almost better than I remembered him. Unlike Sonny's, Chuckle's gray crew cut included all the hair on top, and his body was eerily fit and tan, like he could do a triathlon around the block right now in his bathrobe and slippers. They don't have us in directory assistance around here, Chuckle said, stepping around me to get my suitcase. How'd you find it? Where you find everything. What does that mean? The World Wide Web, I said. And you're still a professor? As far as I know, I said, PhDs don't really go away. Well, that's lucky, Chuckles said, as he and Sonny dragged my suitcase and carry-ons past a dribbling water fountain on the way to the elevator. And what are you doing in Honolulu anyway? Is there a conference here or something? Probably. What does that mean, probably, Chuckles added. How long are you here? She's here for as long as she wants to be, right? Sonny said, smiling at me. Maybe she's on a whatchamacallit for a year or something. You mean a sabbatical? I said, yeah, totally, Sonny said, still smiling. That's what I mean. And then he pulled me in for another hug. I don't know quite how long yet, actually, I said, looking over Sonny's shoulder at Chuckles. Why? Well, I think we all know why, Penelope, Chuckles said. According to Sonny, who regaled us with his most recent version of reality all the way up in the elevator, the Kualialani was named after a Hawaiian goddess by the same name, who was responsible for controlling all the different tides of the Pacific and all the storms. But later, when I Googled, I found out, of course, that Kualialani is an obscure colloquial term for residence in Hawaiian, or more accurately, the word for place, which, unlike most of the things that tend to roll out of my brother's mouth, happens to be the God's honest truth. The Kualialani is definitely a place. It occurs between a series of military-owned golf courses, a Chinese graveyard, and the Pacific Ocean. It is a skyscraper also, and we happen to be dangling in a glass enclosure somewhere on the 18th floor of it. All you can see off the balcony are millions of gallons of salt water and a cascade of marine mammals that leap up every so often to shake their flippers at us. Sonny, Chuckles calls into the living room again. Get up, your sister has a question for you. No, no, I don't, I say in a loud voice. I do not. Yes, you do. Nope. Not playing any memory lane games with either of you two right now about anything, I say, but it doesn't do the trick. Hey, Sonny, Chuckles continues, peeling one of the popsicles for himself. Your sister wants to know something important this morning. She wants to know how different love is from fear. This question is not original, of course, but comes from the newest draft of the Fuentes galley I made the mistake of bringing into the kitchen with me this morning. Any award-winning academic materials contained in a binding with my name on them should never come into a room where Chuckles is. No grant materials or ISBN numbers, no stray CVs or honorariums, no monographs or section notes from dissertations. This goes back to the days of yore, when everything I did, in his opinion, was just regurgitated ravings from Our Lady's tainted brain. The laureate's wondering about love and fear this morning, Sonny, Chuckles says, holding the manuscript at arm's length so he can read it out loud to us without his glasses. Remember this question from way back? I do. Love can isolate us from everything around us, your sister says. But in its absence, we can be filled with the fear that something comparable exists. He's wrong, Sonny, I say at a high volume, directed toward the living room. I did not write that. Carlos Fuentes did, and this is a completely different paper. Not that different, Chuggles says. What are some of the new quotes? I don't deconstruct my work on demand, I tell him. Get a monkey to do it. Oh, come on now, Chuckles says, smiling, it's fun. You were writing about this in high school. Is Jean Seberg in it and the Black Panthers? Is Joan of Arc? I'm aware that genius is a joke to you, I say, holding out my hand for the galley. But Fuentes was in love with Seberg. She was a revolutionary. And a schizoid, too, conveniently, who was out of her mind, and an actress, who went missing for 10 days and was found dead in a car, naked, wrapped in a blanket, I say, patting the countertop in front of where I'm sitting. You can set it down now, please. Time's up, okay? Just give it to me. But Chuckles doesn't let go of my pages, straining to hear what might come from you-know-who out in the love seat where he sleeps, which is on the other side of the coffee table from the recliner where I sleep, since we became not just one but two adult children living in a 750-square-foot condominium with their father. The Perkins Memorial Prize and Fellowship, Sonny, Chuckles continues, and your sister here's the winner of it. Extreme Attention, it's called. Discourses on Love and Fear in the Work of Carlos Fuentes. What do you make of that? It's Perkins Clay Memorial Prize, by the way, I say, breaking the period of total silence that follows. Not Perkins just by itself. I stand corrected, Chuckles says, and this kid has got to get up. He plops the galley in my lap and bends down into the lower two cupboards beneath the half fridge to yank out a blender. An act that seems strange, given there's nothing to mix in it. Anybody for a juice smoothie, he asked, almost to himself. Anybody ever see a lion hug a man? We did, hollers the People versus Sonny Ricks at long last from the living room, his voice muffled a bit by the Afghan covering his face. We all did, in Las Vegas with Mom. A lion with blue eyes and a ton of tigers, white tigers and gay guys. Now one of them's in a coma. There you go, Chuckles says, straightening up from his low squat in front of the cabinets. That always gets to him. Anything about his mom and a juice smoothie, right? That's my boy. You're both lunatics, as far as I'm concerned, I tell him, and I can't believe you let him just keep fantasizing about things that never happened. I dismount the bar stool and scoot it under my father, who sinks down onto it immediately, letting the power of silence reign. Because Las Vegas was near the very end of our family, when Chuckles had the Pontiac Firebird that looked from the front like a human face, and we drove with Our Lady of Perpetual Sadness across the desert with all kinds of plans to witness exotic things we'd never seen before in Sin City. Sonny was just a little kid, and I was in the spring of eighth grade, and after Our Lady had her finale, after she dropped from a high casino balcony on our first day there and tumbled to the ground like a flightless bird, we drove back home alone and unfeathered ourselves, just the three of us, without seeing any of the spectacles that were promised to us. And I held Sonny's hand in the back seat the whole way while Chuckles sobbed over the steering wheel, squeegeeing the bugs off the windshield with his own tears. I slide the Fuentes manuscript into one of the empty utility drawers under the sink and head out of the kitchen. Sonny needs to wear a tie in the courtroom today, I say to the back of Chuckles' head, and remind him, please, that aqua socks do not count as shoes.
Thank you. Wow. That was incredible. So Deb, let's introduce Deb. And excuse the formalities here, but this is a recorded podcast, so we have to do proper introductions for those that aren't here. So Deb Olin Unferth is the author of four books, most recently the story collection Wait Till You See Me Dance. Her fiction and nonfiction appears in Harper's, the Paris Review, Granta Vice, Tin House, The New York Times, and McSweeney's. She has received four Pushcart Prizes, a Creative Capital Grant, and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. An associate professor at the University of Texas in Austin, she also runs a creative writing program at the John B. Connolly Unit, a penitentiary in southern Texas. So give a warm welcome to Deb.
Hi, thanks. We are sharing glasses tonight because I forgot mine.
That's right. And they said they matched the writers together, so they checked our prescription, and it's perfect. It was perfect.
It's so terrific to be here. Thank you so much for coming. It's astonishing. I mean, how do they get so many people here? I'm amazed. It's beautiful. And it's so great to be here with Holiday, who is such an inspiration with the work that she does and with her beautiful writing. And I don't know how she managed to write about an academic with such accuracy when she is not an academic herself. Okay, so I'm going to read just the first part of a story. The whole story takes place in about 15 minutes, but I'm only going to read half of it, so I guess it takes place in about 7 or 8 minutes, but it takes me about 10 minutes or 12 minutes to read. So it's called The First Full Thought of Her Life. Her dream had been to go there. The whole time she was pregnant, each time she imagined it, how they'd all climb the sand dune, how they'd stand in the sun at the top, the breeze, the lake in the distance, the photo they'd bring home of their hands raised in triumph. They lost the rental car in the lot and almost didn't make it. Found the car, couldn't find the exit, couldn't find the road, found the wrong road, found the right road, arrived finally. The parking lot was half full. The dune was so white it looked like aluminum. A flawless day. The shooter was already in position at that point. The father pulled the visor down and said that a dune is a pile of sand on a parking lot. He said that people wrote books, created myths, invented whole philosophies about trudging uphill in hot sand, the futility of such an enterprise. He said that a glacier dropped this stuff off here and left 10,000 years ago. Sand is unhygienic, full of prehistoric infection. He was out of the car now, frowning into the back seat, attempting to dislodge the baby from her car seat. The little girl said that pee is unhygienic, and the father agreed. But the mother had climbed the same dune as a child, and now she'd brought her own family here on a mission of making memories for her daughter, hopefully ones as good as the best of her own, and this dune had been among them. You couldn't drive right up to it back then. You hiked a path through sandy woods. None of that was here anymore, but you could still go up and come down. The same sand carried away on the bottoms of your shoes. The shooter was in a silver pickup, 2013 maybe. Green license plates, Colorado, first letter Y. The girl and the mother walked around the shooter's fender and started up the dune. 3 miles away, a dozen families were waiting for the boat ride, a tour of tiny islands seen from afar. 2 miles away, a dozen families were creating devastation by the pool, pieces of meat and bread, toys that made strange noises, hairpins and spilled drinks, smeared ketchup. The shooter's primary weapon lay across his lap, a Bushmaster AR-15 semi-automatic rifle. He also had a 12-gauge sawed-off shotgun for short range if necessary. E had used a 12-gauge sawed-off shotgun. D had used an Intratec 9mm semi-automatic handgun attached to a strap. N had used such an inferior weapon as to be almost adorable, but that was in 1967. L had brought 6,300 rounds of ammunition, which seemed either paranoid or optimistic or like showing off. Y had had a multitude of weapons, an AR-15, a Glock, a Sig Sauer handgun. F and C had had sawed-off shotguns 30 years old. They'd had bombs and knives, a real showdown. White sand. The angle was steep. There'd be nowhere to run, and sand is heavy. It would all be in slow motion, Keaton-esque. It was hard to climb in the sand. The mother hadn't counted on that. Halfway up, she paused, stopped to catch her breath, and started again. When they were almost to the top, she stopped again, sat down in the sand. She'd been up half the night, again, with the baby, and then couldn't fall back asleep, and she'd sat on the floor in the bathroom like a drunk. "You go," she said to the girl now. "I'm right here." It was only a few yards, really. Below, the father was walking gingerly toward the dune, arms out, as if he were holding a grenade, because the baby was alert, but not yet screaming. Green cargo pants, a black shirt that read, "Don't shoot," a black cap, bill forward, which he'd now taken off and put on the seat beside him. The shooter spotted the girl, a lone child, staggering, her belly protruding, the sand forming a wave to lift her and gently undulate her higher, the girl and the shooter raising his weapon. Oh, the layers under the surface, he thought, the air pockets, the parallel worlds, the possible futures that could explode out of this moment. Oh, thought some birds going by above. The inaccessible inner lives all around us, the lives we can't imagine, the water world, the dominion of the insects. There is, thought the baby, how time doesn't work the way we think it does, or space either. The scientists have it all wrong, and someday we will know this, or someone will. There is, thought the father, how people think their lives are one thing, but they are not. They think they know the world. What entitled, self-satisfied assholes. Ahem. The mother would just like to chime in at this juncture, if all parties have quite finished philosophizing, if she wouldn't be interrupting anything urgent, if everyone isn't too busy. Sure. Did her husband just propose that she has an illusion of certainty? Did he just suggest she thinks she knows the world? And you, shooter, did you assume you'd be introducing something to this family by flattening the girl out dead and bloody right before their eyes? Well, surely it'd be a shock. In fact, there'd already been a shooter introduced to this family. There had? Her husband, shot as a child in the head. The father below, the one who's afraid of sand, he'd already been shot. Lived anyway, in the head. It had been a break-in. His mother had been unable to protect him, picked off at 5 years old. World is full of danger. And he was fine, the husband? Fine enough, no pituitary gland. Those things don't just grow back like a tomato. To this day, he had to medicate with hormones every night of his life or he'd die. Try looking that one in the face, Mr. Shooter. Well, the shooter wasn't going to go for the head. Jesus. The middle, he'd get it right in the heart. We'll see about that, Mr. Stupid. At the bottom of the dune, another family was arriving, the inside of their car like a circus, ponies and dolls, a tinkling music, glitter sprayed over the seats along with other less respectable spills. Half a mile down the road, another father had pulled to the side of the road and was saying, "Could they just shut up back there? Could they please, goddammit, shut up for 30 seconds while he figured out where they were?" Oh, if he had any notion of the clatter of deaths and broken bodies behind this family. He thought they didn't know suffering. At 12, she'd nursed her mother through an illness that lasted 300 days. She had a brother, now in a grave in a desert. She'd had another baby before these two hadn't made it out alive. There had been her grandmother, whom she'd never met, locked up at 40 and never seen again, so that her father had had a hole in him while he raised her. There'd been plenty of others, dead or alive but damaged. Earth is full of them, more assembling and disassembling every day. Among them, yes, this perfect little girl, but she'd been pretty unlikely, considering. And the baby, don't forget, if the father might put a word in, holding her up at the edge of the lot, 1 foot in the sand. The baby, who had screamed for 8 months when she was born before settling into an intelligence not yet seen in this family and frankly a bit frightening. Arranging her box in precise rows, sitting alone in a tiny chair with a book, reading. a civilian version of the M16, tremendous instrument, the same kind carried by F at sea, now half hidden behind the sunshade, impossible to see through the tinted glass, only the tip visible as he cracked the window, his body so tense it felt calm. And don't give her any lip about privilege. This family holds representation of nearly all the seven categories of earthly suffering. It earned its privilege through immense striving in the face of grief the shooter will never know. And she knew this because she herself was too busy managing this striving and grief to go take an afternoon out and wander the area with a weapon. Did he think she never looked around and thought, "What a bunch of assholes. I'd like to take them all out." That is a particularly unoriginal thought. She had that thought at the supermarket every week. She saw a whole plane full of people having that thought on the tarmac 3 days before. She'd think it right now if she took the time to look around, but she wouldn't because she was busy, unlike stupid over here. She had other things on her mind. The idea of killing everyone around her was just one little pile of thought in her brain, off in a corner, might get stepped on and tracked around on her shoe. Her mind was fertile with thoughts, all of them growing and twisting, filling the space, filling the sky, most of them more honorable than that. She'd take this guy on. She would. Seven categories? Poverty. Her husband grew up in a concrete house by a swamp. Her husband's family picked garbage to eat, and her husband grew up among them. His brother spent half his life in prison and came out with so many tattoos he looked like a comic book. Political strife. On her mother's side, she was descended from a race that had been chased over every continent. For thousands of years, her people had had to move at a moment's notice, hide their coins and their hair like magicians. In Europe, her people had been rounded up, placed in cattle cars, and incinerated without ceremony. Practically every relation she should have had was never born. World still despised her race today. Don't think she never felt it. He was drawn by her purposeful tread. When she clearly cleared the top, he'd do it, her full childish figure delineated by the sky. He could hear the cheers of the other shooters of America. He could hear their voices. I think I'll stop there.
Both managed to make death very funny.
Amazing.
Thank you both for those readings. That was really great.
I started by asking Deb to talk a bit about her work in prison education. She founded and runs the Penn City Writers, a 2-year creative writing certificate program at a maximum security prison in southern Texas.
Yeah, so I run this prison program in South Texas at a maximum security prison. It's called the Penn City Writers. And yeah, we have a class of men who are studying creative writing, and it's really amazing. And they're getting college credit now. Woohoo!
It's amazing.
And yeah, and we have our own private library so that they get really good books to read. I choose every single book that goes into the library. And we now have an art program where the guys are matched with different artists around the country who are looking at their work and giving them feedback. So they're doing like prison comics. So cool.
Wow.
And anyway, so I guess that what he was asking is, how did I end up doing that? And so I guess it's because my father was very interested in prison reform work not when I was a kid, but later. And I wrote a story about it that's in here, that's in this book. That might be what you're referring to. And so he did all of this reform work, but I had already left home, and so my whole family got really involved in it. Like, my mom started tutoring the kids of incarcerated people, and my brother went up to this reservation where a lot of the, you know, a lot of the people had been, a lot of the parents had been incarcerated from this one reservation. So my brother went up there and started a computer lab center and started holding classes there. And my dad was, you know, at the prison all the time. And there I was, you know, living, you know, on the other side of the country and just missed out on the whole thing. And they all had so much fun without me. And I miss everything good. So I started my own prison program.
I'll show them.
And yeah, so that's basically what happened. I mean, when I went to, I used to teach at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and they have a prison program there. That was the first place I taught, was in that prison program there. Just when I was, they happened to be starting it when I arrived. And so, and I loved it so much. So then when I came here, I thought I would teach in the prison program here, and they didn't have one. So so that's how I got started. And there are several of my volunteers in this room right now. Right, Lara, at least? There's one. Oh, yeah, Erdiel. Erdiel has been with me from the very beginning. So, all right, so.
Thank you for that. This is a very backwards way to get to that story. But Holiday, I want to talk to you about your story, which is where I wanted to start this. If you don't know, I mentioned this in her intro. Holiday has probably the best bio I've ever seen on the internet on her website, which is hername.com. It's this infographic that starts with prehistoric time. It takes us through really like the history of the world. And there are all these like random milestones, like her brother being born when Dr. Pepper was invented, and it takes us through a lot of things. But some of the interesting tidbits I found in there were your parents meeting at a library. Yeah, is that right?
Yeah, they met on the steps of a library. But my dad was in the army. On the day that my brother was born, Dr. Pepper came to the PX. You know, we were in northern Japan. And it was like a really big deal for my dad to go get this Dr. Pepper. And it was this whole big argument about it at the hospital.
You have had many, many jobs, experiences. You've lived many places.
Yeah.
Can you give us like the Cliff Notes version of that?
Well, my dad was in the army when I... and he was stationed in northern Japan, but we moved... pretty much every couple years my whole life, even after he left the military. So we lived in Bangkok, the Philippines, in Guam, in Hokkaido, Japan, and then like Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and all over. We lived in five different places within the same neighborhood in high school. So yeah.
That's a lot.
We never really unpacked.
And you mentioned in this bio that Helter Skelter was what inspired you to write?
Yeah, my mom was in that Columbia book club, you know, where they'd send you a book. So she'd hide them under the bed. So it was like Erica Jong and Helter Skelter. So, of course, I would go down there and read them first. Not that she knew, you know, but... yeah.
Why Helter Skelter? What about that book at that time? Like, you know, what struck you?
Well... it was how I kind of learned about culture was her Columbia Book Club. And she would have book club and they'd kind of have white wine and her friends would come over and it was the 70s, you know. And I would be up in my room reading Helter Skelter with my friends. And it just was like when I moved to Los Angeles, then I started meeting all these weirdly people that were part of that whole story. You know, that knew the guy who wrote the book, and anyway.
So, but in New York, I guess, is where you had sort of a formative experience, which, funny enough, speaking of guns, you have your own story.
Well, I just loved Deb's story so much, and the way that the point of view worked in that story was so inspired, and I came to writing through acting, so I was an actor. And then when I moved to New York City, was a waiter, and I worked across from the United Nations at this really awful seafood restaurant. But in the middle of the night is when all the kind of diplomats during the day, underworld at night. So everyone from around the world would come in, and a Serbian and a Croat got in an argument, and they pulled these silencers and held us all against the wall. And the Russian bartender begged for his life and all our lives. And then they just kind of put the guns away and left. And it was this really pivotal moment. And I wrote a monologue about it. And then that's how I started writing and doing all these characters. So, you know, I played the Serbian and the Croat and the different whatever. And so that's kind of how the characters just start to talk like that.
And do you think that's carried through in your work?
Yeah, it kind of carried through. But I really, that was very, spoke to me. It had that feeling of the moment. Like you don't know someone's armed and it's just about to happen, you know, from all the different points of view. There were all these Moroccan waiters that, you know, we would cover them on Ramadan and they'd cover us during Thanksgiving and Christmas. And it was a great group of people.
And it just diffused.
Yeah, yeah. And well, it was like the Star Wars bar, so the music was on. You know, and then the guns came out and this kind of aria of begging for our lives, you know. And one of them was the maitre d' at Lutèce, you know. He would always come in and have a lobster at our horrible restaurant. I don't know why. Every night, like a 3-pound lobster. But then, and then it all happened and everyone's kind of, and then they just put their guns away and they left and then, dun, 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 dun.
Was the gun actually pointed at your head?
The gun was pointed at the guy they wanted to kill. But then all of us were sort of like, should we do? And if we moved a little, then it kind of went like this. So you didn't know what direction it was going to go in. And silencers are big. Whoa. Like when they're at you, like this far away, you know, they're just big.
Can I ask you one question about that?
Yeah.
You know, I always wonder, you know, like it says so much about you, like who you will be in the moment that a gun is pointed at you, you know, like mm-hmm. I think I would just like pee in my pants. so what did you do? Well, you wrote a monologue that says a lot about you, but
yeah.
In the moment, what did you do?
I honestly, that's what I write about in the piece. And it's basically ludicrous. What happened is I was just started thinking about Las Vegas. And Las Vegas figures into stuff that I do, even though I really haven't spent any time there, but it's just this idea of escape and distraction or something. But there was, when I was in, like, I was in women's studies in college, and my professor used to talk semiotically about Las Vegas all the time. And there was something in Las Vegas where you got on a conveyor belt and you could go through, like, Nero's Rome and different things. And that's what I was thinking about, like Nero's Rome and it's burning and we're going through, you know, it was just like a way to escape in your head and just not, and just check out.
Go to Las Vegas.
Go to Las Vegas in your head. It wasn't anything courageous or like noble or anything like that. It's just fantasy.
So Deb, do you have a near-death experience that started your writing?
No, I mean, I'm trying to think if I have anything like that. When I was 18, I dropped out of college and went to Central America to try to join one of the revolutions that was going on. I was like a Sandinista.
Wow.
And, whoa. And I mean, but we were in situations where there was shooting going on around us. But there was never a gun pointed at my head. Like, we lived for a while at an orphanage it was in the middle of a war zone, so there were a lot of bombs and guns going off and things, but we weren't, you know, I was terrified, hiding inside, you know, crying, wanting to leave, not a hero at all. So that's why I think I would definitely pee in my pants.
I just, it's like clueless. Honestly. I mean, I remember as a kid, we landed in Da Nang. That, you know, because in the military, we would fly in the middle of the night, you know. And so one time, my father happened to be on the top of the manifest, and they were like half the back of the plane were soldiers. And they said, why are there women and children on this flight? We're going into Vietnam. And they're like, well, I guess we're going. And so maybe it was just in the background all the time. Maybe that's why your story appealed to me so much.
This brings up something I wanted to talk about later, but it seems like the right moment. I was chatting with Adina and Rebecca earlier, and Adina actually brought up a really good point about kind of the role that fiction can play in social commentary and some of these like big topics where we feel like we're reading the same op-ed all the time. And you know, considering can short fiction sort of play a role where you can take on the perspective of a shooter, of a perpetrator of something? Do you feel like that's something that fiction can be used for in some of the big topics of the day that we're trying to tackle?
Well, I think definitely yes. I mean, I was experiencing it. You know, I just came from Southern California, where my neighborhood, there was a mass shooting and then a fire that started within 24 hours. And, you know, I think something like 300 of these events have happened in our country. And I felt like that right there was the perfect way to look at humanity. It's like every single person is 18 generations of a story. And you can do that in fiction. It's the perfect example to me of why I love short story. Because it is massive and it's short like that. You can do that with our soul in 8 minutes. To me, that's magical and so necessary.
Yeah, and it just, I guess maybe it feels like it can't happen in these op-eds and the way that we tackle something like school shootings or Me Too. I mean, how do you display empathy in a you know, in that nonfiction style of writing? I mean, with short fiction, I'm curious for both of you. I wanted to talk about the form and whether that feels like a constraint or if you feel more free in writing short stories versus longer form.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that I feel free and constrained in basically any form, right? It's all kind of a pain in the ass. But I guess that, it is true that I have more, novels take so long that whatever, you know, you have to commit to something for so long that, you know, by the end you like truly hate it. And so I think with short stories, I can play a lot. I mean, I don't know. I play a lot in novels too, but the it feels more fun, I guess, maybe in short stories.
What about like with character development? How is that different? You know, do you feel like you have less time to really, you know, how do you approach that?
I mean, I feel like you can draw a really clear character in one sentence. And I mean, if you get the tone right, if you get the words right, I mean, I can visualize who that person is. If you give me a sentence of a beautiful written character, I know about their history. I can tell the kind of, you know, the way that they talk. I mean, I feel like fiction really has that power. So yeah, I mean, you can get way, and you can get into specifics when you are drawing out, you know, when you stretch out a character over a long period. But I try really hard to draw pictures of characters in really small spaces, and I think you tend to do that too. I noticed in your piece.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, I haven't written a novel. I have a lot of a novel, and it might take a kajillion years, and I already hate it, but I'm very fickle, but I like, it's like bonsai tree, you know? I feel like it's just, I clip at it, and the creative limitation is what the joy of it is, and how much you could see humanity in each of these things in the tiniest space, and it would refer to a giant tree. Like, you know, short story is a ship in a bottle, and the novel's the whole ship, is what I always say. So,
I love that. Yeah. Do either of you feel like the format of a short story can act as a tool of accessibility for people that might not otherwise be reading? Is it a good entry point?
I I think the form is so important, and I don't know if this is true, but I know in my son's case, and he's 14, I don't feel like they read enough short stories. I wrote to the school because they're reading only novels, and I feel like they need to be reading classical short stories. Like I did. I had this amazing teacher in about eighth grade. I also went to school with Ted Le Guin, who was Ursula Le Guin's son, and you know she would read to us and come into the school. And we read short fiction, and I really feel like it's its own form, and late now it's more like, oh, they're doing short stories and then you'll sell a novel, you know, it but it's its own distinct form and should be studied for all the reasons that Deb was just talking about.
I mean, I guess I just feel like fiction in general is, I feel like fiction in general can do something that no other art form can do. I mean, I guess that every art form has its own specialty, but fiction can get you into the mind of someone in a very particular way. So it has this way of expressing complexity and empathy that is... I mean, and not even just complexity, but contradiction, you know, how you can hold two truths that can't both be true, but somehow are right next to each other, you know, in fiction. And all of my best fiction, all the best fiction that I read does that. And I just feel like, especially now when it just feels like everything is so dumbed down and there's so much pressure to just like or not like, or you know you drive across the landscape and you just see the same store over and over again, you know, just like in every all looks exactly alike, and so, but in fiction, good fiction has so much complexity, and I really think it improves your brain, and it improves how you think and how you can have empathy for other human beings. I just feel like it makes you a stronger, more thoughtful person to read fiction carefully. So I feel like it's really important.
Yeah, I agree with her. But it's soul expansive, and it's about paradox. It's about how we live. It's real. It's how we have, like, the epiphanies, how our minds work, and how we experience conflict and crisis in these flashes. You know, it's not like we have 500 pages to kind of figure something out. To me, it's very much how I experience living is a short story. So I couldn't live without them, because they are mirror that. And the humanity in everything, you know, the tiniest, weirdest contradiction. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting in both of your work, humor really plays a pretty big role. Is that something you can't help? Is that something you try to keep, you stay mindful of when you're writing, to inject the humor into the work? Does it bother you that people say that it's funny? Because, I mean, especially Holiday, in your book, a lot of the reviews are like, it's so funny. But it's dark, too. There's... you know, some big topics that you're approaching.
Yeah, I never think of it like, oh, that's a joke or that's funny. I found my father to be like the darkest, funniest guy I knew, like growing up. And, you know, we're estranged now, but I find the way that he talked and stuff, and the way that my mother did, you know, their rhythms. It was because we'd be in a lot of dark situations and he would say something, and it always just flipped in that way. So it's been a continual inspiration to me.
And Deb, what would you say your relationship to that is?
My father also was incredibly dark and incredibly funny. And so what is it about dads, you know? They can... They're dad jokes, you know. Yeah. Dads are always making. They're always making these kind of dumb jokes to the kids, and then they turn to the mother and make these really dark jokes. Yeah. And so my dad. But I'm sad that you're estranged from your dad. I'm sorry. I am not anymore. So.
Yeah, we may not tomorrow. It may change. You know, we've gone in and out. But he really would say, like, we'd just be in the worst situation. He would say, he had this thing with authority, like, we were somewhere and they were like, you know, do not take the sailboats out at noon onto the lake under any circumstances. And so he'd be just like going out on the lake. I'm like, Dad, there's a sign. There's a sign about, no, it's fine. You know, lightning and thunder, and we go sliding up the beach. And he's like, what are you looking at to everyone? You know, we had to be towed back to the dock in front of just that, just like that, like life-threatening stuff.
To shift gears, let's talk a little bit about the writing process. Where and when do you write? Deb, let me start with you.
Well, I have a little room that I write in that nobody's allowed but me. I just write every morning. As soon as I get up, I just get my coffee, head upstairs. And that's what I do. Did that this morning. Then I went to school, taught that guy right there, and came over here. So yeah, so I write every day in the morning. How about you?
Yeah, same, in the morning. It has to be in the morning. That's when I like it. And then editing is late at night, like a vampire, you know, like up really late and, you know, but and for long periods of time. But the like making that is every morning, get up, take my son to school, walk the dogs, and then go to my wherever I'm writing. But I write all over now. I used to just have to write at my desk in a certain way, but now I write a lot more with pen and pencil or pad than I used to.
Yeah, you mentioned something about like a 10-minute exercise that you do. Do you still
So writing? Everything comes from these 10-minute writings, and I remember.
Ooh, tell us, what is it?
Oh yeah, it's a. It's when I was doing performance art and in New York City, it was right around the time and everyone was doing these one person shows. So you'd come and you'd read at the open mic and so we would gather together and do these free writing. So everyone would give a prompt. Everyone would have a spontaneous exercise. So you gave a prompt and you got one. And out of that came kind of basically everything I've ever done. So I always have a writing group, you know, that we ragtag and we meet when we can to do this process. But then I also do it every day. So then, like, my husband will leave me prompts and a hat. That's how desperate I just need ideas. And so he'll
leave
me.
What kind of prompt? Like,
literally anything. Like, he'll say, like, garbage eating or something. And I'll just... You know what I mean? Or something from the newspaper, or like blackout poetry, like anything to kind of
like
just
improv.
Improv, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
About garbage eating, how
about? Yeah, I mean, really random. A definition from the dictionary, or one story from the other book I had. I woke up one day and there were these wet underwear stuck to the driveway. They were these blue underwear, and that I just used. That's how a story, yeah.
Deb, do you have any tools like that you use?
No, I mean, for a while I was on Twitter and I used my husband to, I would make him give me tweets or else I would tweet about him. So he would have to come up with tweets. I hated being on Twitter. But that's the only time I've ever been able to use my husband for anything like that. But no, I do 20-minute writing exercises all the time. I feel like for a while I stopped, and then I met this guy who writes he writes philosophy, and he told me that he writes 15 minutes a day, and he writes books. I was like, how do you do that? And he said, I write 15 minutes a day, and then the rest of the day I can do whatever I want. So that might mean writing all day, but it might not. And so I realized that he didn't mean that he was sort of, because so much of what I do is revising, that those just 20 minutes of just focused blank page writing is so important. Like, I get so many ideas out of it, and I get so much energy from it and weird stuff. And so I started doing them again once he told me that. And
Yeah, total. I agree, because it's like that's really fun for 10 minutes, and the rest is revising, yeah. Like tedium. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have to have the just wild, fun surprise. Yeah. Yeah.
And is that the kind of tool you would teach every aspiring writer? Do you think that works for some people, doesn't work for others? Just that sort of open writing exercise?
Yeah, no, I tell my students to do that. I tell them to describe the same corner every day for 30 days, which was something that I did. Like, I would just sit and just stare at the corner of a room and just describe that little corner for 30 days, for 20 minutes each day. And it seems like a really crazy thing to do, but you're not allowed to look at what you did before until you're finished the 30 days. And it seems like a really weird thing to do, but you would be surprised when you have to describe a little, you know, just like a little corner of a room, the things that you come up with and the places you can go, the different approaches you can take. You know, like you can scan way, way out, or you can, you know, be like way in there, like microscope in there. You can just like, you can have so many different perspectives on it that, you know. And then the other thing is, you know, like you want to connect it to what's relevant in the world in some way as well. Like I want my writing to be about the world. I want it to be, you know, about the political environment, about, you know, community. And so how in the world am I going to connect a corner of the room to, you know, what I see is wrong in the world? So it's a challenge.
I love that exercise. I'm going to do that
right?
For 30 days. I have a date for 30 days.
And Holly, you correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't like starting on the computer, right? You have to have pen and paper. Is that still true?
Yeah, yeah. Because the cursor is a problem for me. I have a thing where I need to just keep writing. Like I have to move my wrist and pen and. That gets me going, and then I can do everything else on the computer, and I use it every day. But I have to be in the notebook at some point. And that was weird because, you know, there was a period where all my journals were going to burn because of the house, you know, and we had to get out of there, and the animals had to be evacuated, and you know, we were actually out of town, my husband and I and my son, because my husband was working out of town, and so we went to visit him, and. The person who was caring for our house called us in the middle of the night and said, there's a fire and we have to evacuate. It's coming in like an hour. Do you need anything from the house? And I'm like, no, just get out and get the animals out. He had to put potbelly pigs in the cage and put them in the truck. I mean, it was not nothing to get everybody out. And then my husband said, what about your journals? And I did kind of go, but, you know, what are you going to do?
They survived.
Yeah, they survived.
Wow. I want to open it up to some questions for people, but I do want to talk a little bit about teaching, which seems like it's important for both of you and in your work. Do you find that you learn through teaching? Has teaching, you know, helped your work?
Yeah. I mean, it keeps it relevant. It keeps me on my toes. Like, I find that I get to know, like, I'm kind of in touch with what's happening more in the world because I read what my students are writing, and also in all kinds of ways it helps. And plus, like, I don't want to be by myself all the time, or just me and my husband all the time. I mean, I've got to get out there a little bit. So no, I love teaching. It's amazing.
Yeah, I agree. I would just be in my pajamas, like unshowered, and just I need to get out, and it is absolutely, it's like a life vein. I love to connect with people that are writing, and we get to all talk about it because it's different for every single person, and like what works and what doesn't, and it's to me, like Deb was saying, it keeps everything relevant. And I feel like community for a writer is essential. It's like all the great writing throughout history came from a writing community of some sort. And, you know, it just keeps expanding.
And you're both doing that in pretty unexpected places with the prison work you're doing, Deb. And then you, Holiday, had been doing some workshops in Haiti, yeah?
Yeah, it's you know, my female relatives, my maternal grandmother created what was called the Perry Center, and it was a school for differently abled kids back in the, you know, 50s. And then my great aunt taught literacy in lumber camps in Oregon. And I seem to have kind of gone in that direction. And so I really love teaching in groups like where creativity is kind of a life or death bridge for people. So I was invited to come to Haiti after the earthquake in 2010 to do creative writing workshops. And my husband's an actor, so, and a photographer and a visual artist. And we went down and we taught, it was like about 50 women aged 40 to 10, you know, 10 years old to 40. It was supposed to be 12 to 20, but it was a wide range. And I did those 10-minute writing exercises. And they became a real, and with, in combination with all the arts, it became a real amazing thing to see psychosocial support embedded in disaster relief and how important that is. And it's becoming more and more so. Our executive director is just going to speak at UNESCO about it, actually, because it's this. So we were like, look at how this works. Women are creating communities, mentorship, all sorts of healing is going on. And one of the girls actually said, she's like, you know, people come to Haiti a lot and they bring, you know, rice and water and all of that's important, but it doesn't matter if we don't have hope. And so it was really amazing to see the arts actually being like an emotional triage and being able to get at things indirectly that helped people realize their own resiliency and their own inner strength. And so we've duplicated it. It's a grassroots educational and literacy organization called LIDE Haiti. And it's our staff is, I'm very happy to say, 96% Haitian and 92% women. And all of the women that work are from the community, and the locally sourced food and all of our all of what each program is unique to that community. And so lots of things have come out of that, scholarships, social entrepreneurship, et cetera, et cetera. So.
And I imagine some of the stuff that they're writing once. You know,
yes, and the writing is incredible in the arts. Although, you know, the organization is not about, oh, we're creating these professional artists. It's actually the arts is used as a tool and a stepping stone, although, you know, incredible things are happening in addition to that, too. Some are continuing to write, and we have a big literature library, and yeah. So.
It's amazing that both of you have the similar work, because Deb, it's like you've built libraries and prisons also. Do you see it as a similar thing, where it's, as Holiday kind of said, it's not like you're trying to make these famous writers, but it's a therapeutic tool?
No, we are not doing that. We are trying to turn them into famous writers. Like, yeah, we are.
All right.
We want them to be published. We want them to, we're working really, really hard on, you know, making it a very academic kind of thing. There are a lot of creative writing prison programs in this country that focus on therapeutic efforts. And that's what I did when I started it. Just, you know, I just started going to the prison and doing these. I didn't really know what else to do. And they got kind of mad at me and they kind of read me the riot act. They were like, look, we want to learn how to write. Like, we, you know, this is, you know, patronizing of you to come here and, you know, act like, you know, us writing these little stories is going to help us. You know, we want to learn how to write. We want to be able to write to our children who aren't in prison with us, and we miss them, and we want to write intelligently to them. We want to be able to write our, you know, about our lives and maybe publish them one day and have our stories told. We want to be able to write to the warden about our concerns. We have all kinds of reasons why, you know, we want to be able to get girlfriends. That's another thing. You know, they do a lot of this pen pal stuff. And, you know, writeaprisoner.com for anyone who's... available. So I turned everything around, and we are really serious about doing it. You know, I'm just as hard on them as I am on any student that I have at the university.
And some of the work that they're submitting or writing, I mean, is it surprising you? Has anything stuck with you? Any like recent examples?
Oh yeah, stuff is getting out there. I mean, there are a few pieces that have been published so far, and they are getting better and better. So yeah, and we publish a journal. We publish our own journal, and and they've had a bunch of pieces published in various online places, mostly. So yeah, look out.
Good. Beautiful.
And I would love to see. I mean, our ultimate goal is like a YouTube channel and different. So that Haitian girls are in contact with the Haitian girls throughout the country, because there's many ways that communities can be isolated. And that is their wish, and I have no doubt that writing will be seen within that context for sure. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. Incredible that you're both doing that work in addition to such brilliant writing. I wanted to open this up to anybody that may have questions for either Deb or Holiday. Yes, here, I'll do this dance.
Hi, I guess this can be for either or both of y'all, but I'm mainly interested to hear whether or not you think literary fiction is distinctly different from genre fiction or more of a genre itself.
I think it's different. I mean, I think this is one person's opinion from one freeway exit in California or whatever. But I feel like, for me, I guess I would describe something more that's genre that is more heavily plot based, and literary fiction more language and character driven. And I think there's not kind of one or the other for me, but for me, my heart is with literary fiction that really delves into where language and character meet and explode, you know, the human heart in conflict with itself and all that. Although I think they're great genre characters. I don't know them as well. I know what's happening to them, but I don't know them the way that I do in literary fiction. That's been my experience.
Yeah, I guess I feel like there was a time when I would have just come down hard for literary fiction. But I think that now, I think that because the way the world feels like such sci-fi, my experience just feels like sci-fi, that that my writing interests have shifted. Like right now, most of what I'm writing is sci-fi. And my novel that is coming out next year is not sci-fi, but it starts just getting into it. Like you see like 20,000 years from now, what happens to chickens? And, you know, it's like you get these different, you know, things. So yeah, the world is so strange now that it's kind of necessary to stretch beyond reality for me to express my feelings about it.
I always felt like life was sci-fi. Like living room, family, kitchen sink drama felt like sci-fi to me. I don't know. Maybe it all comes full circle.
Here we go.
I'm just curious, as fiction writers going into prisons where you're asking people to draw on their own experiences and relate those experiences in this era of fake news, I hate to even use that word, where based on a true story is so powerful to people, how you represent fiction as a way into the soul?
Well, I mean, the men at the prison, they can write whatever they want, and a lot of them, they write about 40 or 50% memoir, which is fine with me, and they write personal essays, and we're trying to branch out as well into things like how to write application essays, you know, like just trying to teach them how to do every kind of writing that might be useful to them. But in terms of fiction in particular, I mean, the thing is, like, they really, it was at the prison that kind of brought me back from a dark place with fiction, because I sort of started to feel like, you know, what is the point in fiction? I mean, nobody really reads anymore. You know, this was the narrative in my head. Nobody really reads anymore. Blah, blah, blah. Who cares? And then I started teaching at this prison, and I would bring stories, and it was like so, they just meant so much to them, these stories. And I mean, I think it's because they don't have any access to the internet, and they don't have iPhones or anything. So it was like they had to just like study these words. And so I don't know, it just, their faith in the story really reinvigorated my own faith in the story. And they, so they just bring it to me. I don't need to do anything. They've already got it.
Yeah, I have the same experience. But I teach there. I've been taught a lot of workshops in the U.S. I've found that this has just been my personal experience. And I don't ask for any type of writing per se, but I find that when I first begin teaching, students are more likely to write autobiographically, directly, and more memoir, or you know, and then kind of move into fiction. But my experience in Haiti is the opposite, that it's much more imagined, and that as more and more imagined world, then there's more autobiography that comes in. So that's just something that I've noticed, yeah.
Any other questions out there? Making sure I'm not missing anybody. Cool. How are we doing on time? Cool. Awesome. So lastly, I kind of want to ask you both to maybe share some things that you wish you knew when you were younger, maybe things that you're imparting when you teach that you're like, man, I wish somebody told me that way back when.
Wow.
Don't marry him, about my first husband.
I don't have wishes about that. I mean, I wish I would have been asked more questions by a lot of people, all people. Like in the 70s and stuff. Like,
questions.
How are you? How are you doing? What's going on inside the thing that's your head is connected to on your neck?
Are you getting asked that now,
though? But no, yeah, well, I think I don't know, though, because maybe if I had been asked a bunch of questions, I wouldn't have made stuff up and just spent most of my time writing things down and imagining, you know? But I will say that all my best memories and best teachers were the writers, my English teachers and my fiction teachers. I mean, they were incredible, yeah.
And for both of you, are there peers, other writers that kind of keep you, other than your students and the people you're teaching, people that inspire you now, keep you going?
So many.
So many. Yeah,
I had so many more days of the week and hours to read the books of these incredible writing. So incredible. I couldn't even. I have one book, though, for me personally, that just changed my life. I feel like it's this anthology that I go back to again and again, and it was at a period in my life where I was being a performance artist, but I really wanted to write fiction. And it's called The Vintage Collection of American Short Stories. And it came out in like 1984, and it was Tobias Wolff edited it. And those stories in there, I still just, for me, that was a seminal book.
I think that a couple of my seminal books would be Edward P. Jones wrote a novel, The Known World, which is just my favorite. I think it's my favorite book of all time. And Julie Doucet is a comic book artist whose work I really, really love. There are just so many. So many.
Well, thank you both so, so, so much for taking time to be here with us tonight, sharing stories, reading stories. You're both incredible readers, too, vocally.
What was that saying? There's some saying, like, how to be a writer. It's like, eat, sleep, read, write, repeat until dead, or something like that.
There it is. Thank you all so much.